This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. On today's show, Bridge Magazine's Truth Squad is back and four candidates' claims get some scrutiny.
Well, actually, the 540,000 job stat is true if you go back to 2010. And Right to Work was passed in December of 2012.
There's a new book that looks at the environmental history of Lake Superior.
Just because it's a really big lake, dilution is not the solution to pollution.
At the Winter Olympics in South Korea, most of the snow you see is made by a Michigan company.
Outside of our equipment, there's maybe an inch in the shaded areas.
And on average, 401k retirement plans are woefully underfunded. Some people just skip it altogether.
There's no direct, obvious penalty. And a lot of people decide, well, I'm going to not participate.
Plus, the Attorney General's office and a judge put a halt to compensation for some people wrongfully convicted. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. This hour, an update from Bridge Magazine's Truth Squad, fact-checking claims by candidates running for Michigan governor. Plus, our innovation series, The Next Idea, comes to an end after 3 years. We'll take a look back at some of the highlights. But first, you remember that new law that requires people who are wrongfully convicted should be compensated $50,000 for each year in prison? That new law indicates people wrongfully convicted have 18 months after it went into effect to file claims. That date would be September 29th of this year. But Attorney General Bill Schuette's office argues, no, that's not the deadline. Another law from 1961 requires any claim against the state has to be filed within 6 months. The News Service Gong Warder reports Judge Michael Talbot with the Court of Claims agrees with that. Talbot is turning compensation requests down if they didn't come in by the shorter deadline. Joining us now is an attorney representing some of those people who were wrongfully convicted and now find out because of this technicality ferreted out by the Attorney General's office, her clients are not going to be compensated for the years they were wrongfully put in prison by the state. Gabby Silver, when did you find out about this?
Well, to be honest with you, it's only one of the clients that we represent in the Wrongful Incarceration Compensation Act. We represent six individuals, and only one of those individuals is being denied because of a failure to file by September 29th. So we found out, we filed his claim in October, and we received a motion for summary disposition from the Attorney General's office sometime after that.
Okay, so I've got a conflict here. So
sure.
The date I had was September 29th of 2018. Is that wrong?
Well, no, because see, what happened is while those of us, many of us who are filing lawsuits under this act, believed that there was an 18-month statute of limitations, I didn't participate in the writing of the legislation, of course, or in any of the hearings that resulted in the legislation. However, after talking to people that did, it's my understanding that originally the plaintiffs, the people suing, were trying to get a 3-year statute of limitations. However, the Attorney General's office pushed for the 18-month statute of limitations. So we sort of believed that it was a standalone statute and that we had 18 months within which to file these claims. Of course, then we find out that, no, it's not a standalone piece of legislation. You were required to notify the state within 6 months and under the Court of Claims rules.
Well, surely the Attorney General's office warned these wrongfully convicted people who are supposed to be compensated that it saw a conflict between the new law and the 1961 law, right?
Wait, what? The Attorney General's office did what?
I'm asking. Surely, they warned you.
No, of course not. No. And, you know, the thing about it is that, first of all, there's a list of exonerees. So we know that, at least that's a starting point of all these individuals that were exonerated. There are probably people out there who were convicted years ago who have never filed a claim because they really didn't know. Now they're going to be precluded because if they didn't notify the state by September 29th of 2017, out of luck, can't file claims.
How many wrongfully convicted people has the Court of Claims ruled missed this deadline and get nothing?
Okay, so I'm not sure at this point of the exact number, and we checked this yesterday, but I think that there are 16 cases that for one reason or another have been dismissed in the Court of Claims. I only have one individual who we filed after the September 29th deadline. There are other attorneys out there, though, who have a number of clients who filed past that deadline and are you know, SOL, as they say.
Attorney General Bill Schuette's office seems to be saying, hey, the law is the law. The lawyers for these wrongfully convicted people screwed up. Those people the state put in prison but were released years or decades later because their convictions were overturned are just out of luck. So what can be done about this?
That is a kind, compassionate thing to say to people who spent, some of them, decades in prison for crimes they didn't commit. It's my understanding that there may be some changes proposed to the legislation to really make it what everybody anticipated that it would be, which is an 18-month statute of limitations, although that hasn't happened yet. But it is my understanding that there is something in the works to hopefully tighten things up so people who were really so grievously wronged by the criminal justice system aren't wronged again.
So I guess you're in a holding pattern at this point.
I'm in a holding pattern as to one of our clients. And then as to others, I mean, people call us all the time and, you know, we take their names and, you know, we're just telling them, look, you know, you can't recover right now. I don't know. But right now, the AG's office and the Court of Claims says no go for you.
With all this uncertainty, how is this affecting how you can do your job?
Look, it's a ton of work. I mean, we're like holding to the five that we have right now. It's a ton of work. The attorney fees, you know, are limited by this statute to $50,000. And to practically to get where we are now, it's taken that much. I don't think it was anticipated that, you know, people who were exonerated by newly discovered evidence were going to be treated this way by the AG's office in these claims. I just don't think anybody anticipated that it was going to be this burdensome to really get to a place where they can get compensated. The clients are difficult to deal with. They're emotionally a wreck, you know, overwrought. I mean, they thought they would get something. I mean, you're talking about people who lost everything when they went to prison. You know, you're talking about people that were in prison for 20 or 25 years, and when they should be, you know, sort of winding down an employment career, they've never even had one because they were in prison wrongfully. You know, they've got nothing, looking to retirement with nothing. They can't get, you know, Social Security because they've never really worked. I mean, it's just unbelievable.
Is there any route to appeal?
Well, we are right now, the Conrad Montgomery matter, we're appealing. I mean, everything else is, you know, nothing has happened. I mean, Julie Balmer's case is in front of the judge on a motion for summary disposition. We're waiting to hear what happens with that. And the Hires case, we're just going to go to trial, I imagine. We'll have another criminal trial.
That's Gabby Silver. She represents wrongfully convicted people, some of them trying to collect the compensation due to them under the law. But now through a court of claims, judge's ruling finds the deadline set out in the law is not being honored. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you. Have a great day.
We contacted Attorney General Bill Schuette's office. Spokeswoman Andrea Beitley sent us this statement. Quote, our job is to enforce state law and to make sure that the procedure is followed. The Court of Claims has a set of rules that you have to follow. We are enforcing the rule that attorneys have to provide notice by the six-month mark of their intent to seek compensation for their clients. If legislation needs to be enacted or rules need to be changed, that discussion needs to be had. It shouldn't be people complaining. It should be people acting. And then Beitley adds, I think the quote is, be the change you want to see in the world. End quote. If you miss any part of today's show, you can find it on our podcast. Just go to michiganradio.org and click on podcast to find the link.
The state of Michigan.
Ensuring quality products today.
If you've been watching the Winter Olympics in South Korea, there's a pretty good chance you've seen the product of a Michigan company. The snow on the ski slopes is manufactured snow, fake snow, made by Snowmakers Incorporated based in Midland. Joining us now is Brooke Vanderkellen Alba, who is in sales and marketing at SMI. This is not your first Winter Olympics. What were the challenges this time?
Yeah, this is actually our seventh Winter Olympics. So we've been through a couple now. For this one, it is very cold. I'm not sure if you've heard about that, but a lot of the cold air is coming from Siberia. So between that and very steep and rocky terrain, this was a brand new ski resort developed actually for the Olympics. So we had to bring in a lot of construction equipment and be able to install this equipment on a pretty remote location.
How much snow was on the ground when you guys got there?
Outside of our equipment, there's maybe an inch in the shaded areas.
Yeah, that's not going to work, right?
Yeah, probably not the best venue for an Olympic event.
So how much snow have you had to make for the Olympics this year?
Yeah, so we've made about 6 to 8 feet across all of our venues. For the Zhongshan Alpine Center, that's about 200 acres.
You were talking about the construction needed to hold the equipment you need, but you had to send all kinds of equipment over there. How much do you need for a project like Winter Olympics?
Yes, specifically for the Alpine Center, which is hosting the downhill, the Super G, and the downhill combined Olympic events. We supplied over 130 snowmakers just for those five trails to be covered.
Wow, sounds like a logistical nightmare. Do those specific machines that you use now have special cachet? I mean, they're Olympic snowmakers, right? Where do they go next?
So they're actually staying there.
Ah.
So the Alpine venue actually purchased our equipment, and they've been talking about opening the center to the public.
Oh, that's great. Through the years, have the needs of the athletes caused you to change the kind of snow that you manufacture?
Not necessarily. The majority of our business is for ski resorts such as Vail or Beaver Creek. We have always tried to provide the best quality of snow, so depending on the temperature, we'll change the amount of water and air. And actually, surprisingly enough, the athletes really enjoy skiing on our snow because it's a more consistent quality from top to bottom.
Ah, right. I was reading in your Snow SMI News magazine about nozzles and things like that. It's fascinating what goes into these things, and it looks like you can make just about any texture of snow you want with this equipment.
Yeah. So for a more commercial ski resort, it's pretty much 2-to-1 in terms of snow to water input. But for a racing type snow, we do actually, it's like 1.7-to-1. So it's a wetter, harder snow. So we can adjust the amount of water and the quality of snow depending on what the end user would like.
That is Brooke Vanderkellen Alba with Snowmakers Incorporated in Midland. The company is making snow for the Winter Olympics. Thanks for talking with us.
No problem at all. Thanks for having me.
Up next, we talk with an environmental historian at Michigan Technological University. Her new book is called Sustaining Lake Superior.
Just because it's a really big lake, dilution is not the solution to pollution.
An extraordinary lake in a changing world. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham and for Cynthia Canty. If you've never visited Lake Superior, you really ought to put it on your bucket list. It is awe-inspiring on so many levels, but it's also challenged. It seems pristine, but a couple of centuries of exploitation have taken its toll. There is a new book that traces the history of the lake and some of those indignities that it's suffered because of humans. The book's title is Sustaining Lake Superior, An Extraordinary Lake in a Changing World. The author is Nancy Langston, and she joins us now via Skype. I was aware of a number of the problems Lake Superior has and is facing, but having the entire history of what we've done to Superior was really disturbing. But before we get to that, you live on the lake. Where and why there?
I live in Hancock, Michigan, and I moved here from Madison, Wisconsin, because there's a great university here, Michigan Tech, which had a new Great Lakes Research Center. So I jumped at the opportunity to live as close to Lake Superior as possible because I'm fascinated by the lake. For 14 years, I've spent as much time as possible on the lake. And I realized that the opportunity to actually live in the watershed and experience the changes that it's going through right now would really enrich my research and be a key part of the community I want to live within.
You say Lake Superior fascinates you. In what way? How?
It's the largest freshwater lake in the world, which is pretty astonishing. People see it as a very remote, untouched, pristine place. But what is so fascinating about Lake Superior is it is a place that underwent some very intense industrialization and changes in the 19th century. It was the center of the copper mining boom that enabled electrification across the United States. It was the center of the iron mining industry that enabled our incredible industrial expansion because it was key to the steel industry. It was the source of some of the greatest fishing, the fur trading in the world. It was massively changed by logging. And yet, in many ways, the watershed and the lake recovered in the 20th century, especially after World War II. So one of the great stories, I think, of the lake is not that it's pristine and untouched because it's fairly clean right now. But one of the great stories is that ecosystems can recover. They're resilient if we give them a chance. And so I think the conservation recoveries of Lake Superior over the past century teach us really important lessons now that we face the greatest challenge, which is climate change.
So you mentioned a number of the things that have happened to the lake. I want to go back to what I think is the beginning, the damage to the lake that started as early as the voyageurs who harvested pelts. What happened when they took so many beaver?
This was an ecosystem that was largely shaped by beaver activity and changing the flow of the water and absorbing nutrients and absorbing pollutants. So when beaver were pulled very quickly out of the system, the land lost its ability to assimilate and break down many of the pollutants. And people did not realize that what had really allowed the landscape and the watershed to be so resilient was removed very quickly when beaver were taken out.
From there, as you mentioned, forests were cut, mines were exploited, copper, iron, then taconite, agriculture, channeling streams, overfishing, habitat damage, paper mills, exotic and invasive species. Take your pick. I mean, what's been the most damaging to the lake?
I think it's impossible to say if any one thing has been the most damaging in the past. I trained as a forester, so I would tend to say deforestation really radically changed the watershed very, very quickly. But pollutants as well, the mass infusion of pollutants into the lake, first from local mining industry, and then more recently from global transport of contaminants such as mercury from coal burning, that both local and distant sources of pollutants have had tremendous impacts on the lake.
You talked about the 20th century recovery. This combination of pollution and exploitation seems to have gone in some cycles over the last couple of hundred years. What, if anything, did we learn as damage started to become evident in each decade that something else was affecting the lake?
Just because it's a really big lake, dilution is not the solution to pollution. We used to think that, sure, some of these industries could pollute, but since it's the biggest lake in the world, surely a few drops of contaminants wouldn't destroy things. And as pollutants actually accumulated, they bioaccumulated. So tiny, tiny low doses in the water, it turned out, could accumulate up the food chain until they became so significant in the large fish and in the people and the birds that ate that fish that those animals were at risk of extinction. So we learned that even though it's a really big lake, pollutants move in really complicated ways, and we can't just assume that natural systems will break down our pollution, that we need to restore health by restoring forests and by working together across political boundaries to protect the lake.
Today, we expect, when it's working right, government will protect natural resources like Lake Superior. Where was the government when companies were getting rich at the expense of damage to Lake Superior?
The state governments were initially really trying, but they had two different things that sometimes contradicted each other. First of all, their job was to protect water. Minnesota especially, but also Michigan and Wisconsin, really wanted to protect clean water for their citizens, because by the 19th century, they realized that pollution killed people. But at the same time, they felt it was their job to encourage economic development, because they also realized poverty kills people. So they were trying to balance these two dynamics, more jobs and more pollution control. And at times they recognize that sustaining forests, protecting forests could help you have both pollution control and economic development. But when they were faced with the challenge of controlling pollution from mines and paper mills, they often felt that they could just hope the pollution would go away and it wouldn't be very significant, so they could have the jobs without having to really wrestle with pollution.
So we have this legacy pollution. You quote Dave Dempsey, who many people know as an author and an activist. He said cleanup efforts, restoration, has been ultimately ineffective because of reluctance by politicians to break ranks with industrial interests defending the status quo. What kind of pressures are there against cleaning up toxic hotspots like the so-called areas of concern in the Great Lakes?
Sure. Dave Dempsey was referring to the Great Lakes Water Quality Act, which seemed like such an incredible possibility in the 1970s, where the two countries, U.S. and Canada, were going to come together to restore these extraordinary waters, all the Great Lakes, not just Lake Superior. But it turned out that the International Joint Commission, which was in charge of the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreements, didn't have any political power to force the two nations to actually meet their agreements. Over and over again, the two nations said, well, we want to control mercury, but not right now. So the two nations ended up relying on so-called voluntary agreements. They said, we'll just encourage companies to take voluntary steps to reduce pollutants rather than actually forcing them to meet their obligations. Voluntary agreements only work when you have a very persuasive fine or when you have ways to force companies and industries to actually abide by their agreements.
Lake Superior is so vast, it's so deep, it's kind of hard to imagine it can be damaged permanently by the human activity on the edges, the shores, but it has been. But you also point out there are global threats. There are contaminants coming from other places, and we also have to deal with climate change. Could you tell us about some of these global threats to Lake Superior?
Sure. One of the key global threats are called the persistent pollutants, and mercury is a really good example. So we have some within-basin sources of mercury, the taconite processing facilities on the North Shore of Minnesota still produce a large amount of mercury. We have the technologies to get that out of the air before it eventually makes its way into the water, but the state has chosen not to enforce those requirements. The federal government was supposed to step in March of 2017, and Pruitt and Zinca just decided not to actually enforce those standards. So we know how to do this. We have the laws, but they aren't being enforced. But the biggest source of mercury in the basin is actually coming from coal combustion. And coal combustion, of course, is also one of the key sources of climate change. And so the simple, most effective thing we can do right now to protect the Great Lakes and Lake Superior in particular is simply move beyond coal, use other technologies that are much less damaging. And this requires action on the global level as well as on the local level. But it's of key importance for local communities because 10% of human babies born in the Lake Superior watershed at the moment of birth have toxic levels of mercury already in their blood. And that profoundly affects their development, their ability to live full, healthy lives. And so we need to act globally as well as locally to reduce these threats.
What's your hope for the future of Lake Superior?
We move beyond coal, that we restore and help restore the resiliency of this world's largest lake. Nothing in the future is going to be as important as clean water and healthy ecosystems. We rely on clean water for every single thing we do. And this is the largest swarming lake in the world and the head of a basin that provides 21% of the world's fresh water. The Great Lakes are an extraordinary global resource, and it's up to us to actually protect and restore them. So my hope for the future is that we come together across political boundaries. We continue the restoration of toxic sites. We actually see Republicans as well as Democrats right now across the Great Lakes really standing up for continuing the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative that was started more than a decade ago and needs to continue to have hope for the future.
Nancy Langston is a professor of environment history at Michigan Technological University. The book is Sustaining Lake Superior, an Extraordinary Lake in a Changing World, published by Yale University Press. Thanks very much for telling us about Lake Superior.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs.
Vision.
The best and the brightest.
The next idea.
When we really see each other, we want to help each other.
After 3 years on the air, Stateside's innovation series, The Next Idea, is coming to a close. During that time, we've met innovators of all kinds, business innovators.
We used to have very vibrant commercial corridors where people could, you know, walk to the end of the block, like you said, to find retail, to find food and restaurants. And we need to bring that back to all of our neighborhoods in the city.
Social innovators.
Just return the homes to the people who live in them. Give ownership to those people. You know, we can't make these people wealthy in a matter of a day. We can't make these homes perfect. What we can do is to change the name on the deed.
And we've heard from people trying to do old things in new ways.
One of the main challenges of agriculture from a holistic lens is we have not accounted for the unintended consequences of our decisions. And so because of that, if somebody says, well, it takes more land and we're already pressured, I think we need to move away from this land and feeding the world by the year 2050 and really begin to look at it more from an ecological view.
Along the way, we've met some new Michigan inventors.
I was clipping my nursing bra back together after I got done pumping one day, and I'm just kind of, it hit me. I'm like, why can't something clip onto your bra? Like, that just seems like such an easy solution. I looked, and there was nothing that did that. So I went to my basement and grabbed some old fabric from, I think it was like from a Halloween costume or something, and I started making a prototype in my dining room.
And we've heard about what can inspire an invention.
I started to self-teach thermodynamics. I basically wound up creating my own chiller system from a used central air unit.
Our contributors shared visions of reviving the state's failing infrastructure.
Rather than building these mega project, huge expense infrastructure projects that bring water to buildings, the buildings and the neighborhoods and the ecosystems become the infrastructure.
And theories of how we allow them to fail in the first place.
Well, I think we have a democracy from the top as opposed to democracy from below. And more and more people feel disempowered, fed up, frustrated, cynical. And I think people are just basically fed up and disconnected from the political system.
Along the way, we've had some surprises.
And I was thinking to myself, this is nuts. I'm probably the only warden sitting on the edge of the bed, can't wait to come to work today.
And done some unusual things, like play improv games to help us tap into our creative imaginations.
And
he
never, ever
looked
back.
Yes, there we go.
For so many, personal experience drove them to make change for others.
And we just began to share. And everybody really in that space shared about maybe what their parent challenges were or their individual challenges, some of their trauma. And all of us was kind of just saying, me too. And from that day on, it was like a cloud, the shame cloud, was lifted off of me, right? And I didn't feel so alone in my pain. And from that moment, I wanted to help other people have that same experience.
And with nearly everyone we've talked to on The Next Idea, we've asked them why. Why do they believe their innovations are needed? Why are they important? Most of our answers revolved around the same theme. We want to help.
My ultimate dream is that in 12 years from this January, from May actually, I'll watch that first cohort of kids walk across the graduation stage. And it's not about the $50. It's about the inspiration that we're creating in them and the knowledge that they can be anything they want to be.
Oh my gosh, I would love to see it spread. It would be incredible to see this idea resonate with other people and wanting to take it on and bring it to other people. The whole thought behind it was just to give people support and make other people know that they're not alone and they're okay. And so other people feel like that's incredible and want to bring that to their area. I can't even express how cool it would be to see this as kind of a movement that starts to happen.
Those were the voices of Chase Cantrell, Michelle Oberholzer, Jason Roundtree, Julie Burrell, Emil Ural, Matt Grokoff, Terry Link, Dwayne Burton, David Fessel, Patrice Lucas, Bonnie Geddes, and Adriana Flores. And we'll give the last word on The Next Idea to the youngest contributor of the group, Alina Morris, who invented a teeth-friendly lollipop.
The advice that I would give is the same thing my dad told me when I wanted to start a business, is to write your ideas down and to find people that believe in you and to find people that surround you with good vibrations. Because business is a team sport, honestly. And finally, just to believe in your idea, because if you doubt yourself, it's not going to make anything any easier.
As she said, believe in your idea. It might just help move your state forward. You can see a final essay that includes many links to our Next Idea contributors on our website, michiganradio.org.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
really like to hear from you. We want to know what stories you're thinking about, what issues you want to hear more about. Tell us. Find us on Facebook, search for Michigan Radio. We're also on Twitter, at Stateside Radio, and at michiganradio.org. Just click the link that says Stateside. Still to come, a look at 401k retirement plans and how we use them.
There's most people who have middle to higher income will find that Social Security certainly will not replace their standard of living when they retire, even if they try to cut back expenses.
That's a 10 minutes here on Stateside for Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Michigan Radio is partnering with Bridge Magazine's Truth Squad project this year, as we have for each election year during the past 8 years. I recently sat down with two of Bridge Magazine's reporters to review four Truth Squad reports. First, we'll start with some claims by Bill Schuette, one of the Republicans running for governor. Schuette released what he calls a state of the Michigan taxpayer. Bridge's Lindsay Van Hulley explains Schuette's four-point bulletin.
So he pointed out $8 billion extra paid since the Granholm era income tax increase, $900 million in extra costs related to Governor Snyder's 2011 tax overhaul, which included some taxing on some pension income, related to, you know, the highest auto insurance in the nation, and income, median income is about $5,000 below the national average.
In 2007, during the Great Recession, the state of Michigan was close to a $2 billion deficit. The income tax rate at the time was 3.9%. The legislature and Granholm hiked it to 4.35% with the idea of rolling it back in the future. That didn't actually happen, although it was lower to 4.25% under Governor Snyder. So Schuette is basically right. Michigan taxpayers have paid $8 billion. But there's a caveat.
Part of the context, I think, that's left out is that even with that increase, even at 4.25%, we're still below income tax rates throughout most of Michigan's history collecting it. I think the average rate over about four decades or so was about 4.4%.
Which also means we're far from being one of the highest tax states. As for the claim that taxpayers are paying $900 million more each year as a result of a tax on some pension income and other tax charges, that's a little more sketchy. The implication is that $900 million comes mostly from the pension taxes. Actually, the bulk of that is from closing some tax loopholes. As for household income lagging behind the average for the nation, yep, that's true. The Truth Squad rated Schuette's claims as a little misleading, but mostly accurate. The next Truth Squad report is about a statement and a tweet made by Sri Tanadar, one of the Democrats running for governor. Here's what Tanadar said during a candidates forum in Washtenaw County.
I will close down and outlaw for-profit charter schools in Michigan. No one, including Betsy DeVos, should be profiting from our public school dollars.
Bridge Magazine's Riley Began looked into that claim and found some flaws.
Of course, the governor can't do that alone. He'd have to work with the legislature. And right now, the legislature is pretty Republican-dominated and pretty big supporters of charter schools. So that would be a tall order to do on his own. Their campaign followed up and said they acknowledged that that was a situation that they would need to do that.
Beyond that is the claim that Betsy DeVos, a champion of private charter schools and currently the U.S. Secretary of Education, might profit from those schools. DeVos has declared she removed herself from any investments that might be a conflict of interest. That's hard to verify because private investments are private. However,
it's probably not fair to claim that she is personally making money off of charter schools in Michigan. However, it's definitely fair to say that she has in some ways benefited from the rise of charter schools in Michigan.
Truth Squad ruled Tanadar's claims are mostly accurate. The next Truth Squad report was researched by Bridges' Ted Roloffs. He looked into a statement by Patrick Kolbeck, a Republican running for governor. Kolbeck's trying to link his support for Michigan's right-to-work law to an increase in jobs. He issued a press statement which said, quote, In the wake of the passage of Michigan's right to work legislation, the state has created 540,000 private sector jobs. Lindsay Van Hulley notes that's a little off.
Well, actually, the 540,000 job stat is true if you go back to 2010. And right to work was passed in December of 2012.
Actually, 336,000 jobs have been created since the passage of right to work. But there's still an issue with that.
You know, it's also very difficult to attribute direct job growth to right-to-work legislation. That correlation exists, but it's not right to say that that's causation.
The Truth Squad ruled Colbeck's statement is mostly inaccurate. The final Truth Squad report we're looking at today is regarding a statement and a tweet from Gretchen Whitmer, one of the Democrats running for governor. Riley Began looked into Whitmer's claim.
In late January, she tweeted, "Our state used to pay 75% of your college costs. Today, it's about 25%.
Part of how you determine whether that's correct is how you calculate your college costs. Is that the amount the state gives to the university's general fund or the tuition students pay? Began says it seems it's more about how much the state deposits in universities' bank accounts.
The House Fiscal Agency reported that at a high point in Michigan history, the state was paying 65.6% of the funding to the general fund for our 15 public universities and colleges. Most recently, in 2017, that number was 20.9%. So Whitmer's 75-25 is not too far off, but it's a little off.
The Truth Squad ruled Whitmer's claim is mostly accurate. Throughout this election year, we'll be sharing the Truth Squad's investigations with you. It's going to be an interesting year. Retirement accounts, specifically 401k plans, were never intended to be a substitute for a pension, but the reality is most people, if they have a retirement account, it's a 401k. Last year, the Wall Street Journal ran a piece in which the creators of the 401k worried about what they'd started. The 401k was designed to supplement income from Social Security and a pension. It's supposed to be a three-legged stool. Here to talk about 401ks and how we use them is Frank Stafford. He's a professor of economics at the University of Michigan. When these things first came out, were brokers' claims about 401k plans oversold?
Well, yeah. And of course, at the same time that these came out, there's a rapid demise of the traditional formula plans, the so-called defined benefit plans. With that exit from the firms offering these types of traditional plans, something new looked very attractive.
Well, the companies were saying, okay, pensions are expensive. They're becoming more complicated. There's this 401k tool, and people started getting those, and other people were saying, look at that 401k. They're growing. It was really fast. This looks like a lot better than a pension. So convincing employees wasn't that difficult at the time, right?
Right, and I think people do consider a 401k or the different forms of it a type of pension. And, of course, there's a huge advantage in terms of the taxes because you can put in the money pre-tax dollars, and then you pay taxes when you draw. But another interesting feature is the interim interest that is generated until you draw on it is also subject to no income tax. So it creates this highly favorable thing if you're willing to participate consistently over a long period of time.
And that's the problem, because today for households between ages 50 and 55, the median retirement account balance is $8,000. For those between 56 and 61, the median is $17,000. I don't know how you're going to retire on that.
Well, you won't. That's simple. I mean, but one of the factors we see is, of course, there's so much tapping in to the pensions prior to retirement. Certainly during the Great Recession, there was a lot.
Oh, they're taking loans against their own retirement account.
Right. So they're drawing down, and at a great penalty, they have to rebuild it. The other way that leads to a demise of fund buildup is a decline in participation. So there's fairly heavy penalties for taking money out too early before 59 and a half. But if you just say, well, I'm not participating because I want that money to buy groceries, there's no direct obvious penalty. And a lot of people, that's what we've been looking at recently, decide, well, I'm going to not participate.
Yeah, I mean, at one time, companies were offering like usually a one-to-one match or maybe a half-to-one match, and now a lot of companies don't offer a match at all. There's no real incentive, immediate incentive, to invest in a 401k. What's the likelihood we've got a whole generation, or for that matter, generations, headed into a retirement of poverty?
The answer is yes, we do. I think, again, we do have public pensions, although the whole Social Security system is under some stress, but it's not something that can't be somewhat reasonably corrected. But I think there's most people who have middle to higher income will find that Social Security certainly will not replace their standard of living when they retire, even if they try to cut back expenses. We will, and some people will accumulate very, very little in the way of the Social Security allocation. So I think you're definitely right. I mean, this is a deep concern. And the way that you build up your pension with what's called a defined contribution, such as a 401k, you have to put money into something, the stock market. And our work shows that with each of the more recent recessions, middle and mid-range families who might have owned stocks are very leery of it. If they keep in their pension, they're getting away from stocks. So they say, well, I'm getting away from stocks, but fixed interest funds are so bad.
Right, it's so low. Yeah.
So low, so then they say, well, why do I do either? So we see a lot of exit from 401ks.
I know of a guy who was planning on retiring just about the same time the Great Recession hit, and then he watched his portfolio tank. And I'm wondering, you know, if this, irrational exuberant market we're seeing right now, if it tanks in a few years just before, you know, a lot of us are going to be thinking about retiring, what do you do then? I mean, what do you do when your 401k shrinks to half or two-thirds of what it was?
Right. And I mean, again, there is some restrictions on how the funds are invested. Again, I think there are offerings of aggressive stock funds for your pension. That's not a good idea as I see it. It's also the case that there could be drops. I do feel right now that the stock market, while the prices are very high, the earnings of these companies are also very high. So it's not as extreme as the dot-com bubble where the prices were totally unrelated to earnings.
Right. And with the tax break, that just means the companies should be in better shape than ever, you would think.
That's also true. I do hope that there isn't some lurking systemic factor such as for the Great Recession, which was all the junk mortgages. We do have Bitcoin, so there's busy people with great ambitions to transform the world and make a lot of money. I do worry things that come in as a systemic risk that could jeopardize the value of stocks, even though it's not stocks themselves.
Let's talk about personal finances for a moment. You know, what's the lesson here? What do you recommend to someone if they're 55 and their retirement account is at $8,000? What do you do between now and retirement, 12 years?
Well, I think, first of all, they have to consider extending their work life. Depends on your job. If it's heavy lifting and you're, you know, 65, that's going to be more difficult. If it's using a computer, it's easier to extend your work life. People do come back into the labor force after retiring, but I think they should be careful about exiting too early. Protection, too, they should be looking at other wealth they hold. Have they paid down their mortgages? Regrettably, this has become far less common than it was 30 years ago. So the instant refi has led for many of these pre-retired folks, compared to the historic 30 years ago, having no mortgage or a very small balance, having a substantial balance. So I think one thing, however, that's positive is if they do pay off their mortgage, this is a substantial protection because they can draw on it. They can get a home equity loan.
I was going to say, a lot of people are also doing these reverse mortgages. What do you think of that product?
Those are very complex. There's issues about how fast do you draw it down, and when the person passes away, who's going to sell it? Who's going to claim the outstanding balance and so on? So I think those are assets that do have some attraction, but they do have a lot of practical problems. They're essentially a type of life annuity.
Now, I know you don't predict what Congress is going to do, but If you had a crystal ball here, do you think we're going to have to do something soon about Social Security? It's one of the entitlements that they've been looking at. They're not going to do it to the people who are currently getting it because that would cause a backlash like Washington's never seen. But they can say to guys that are 10, 15 years away from retirement, look, you're not going to get as much as you thought you were.
Yeah, there's going to be some of that. There's going to be somewhat increased taxes. Again, we do have to remember that Social Security is called a contributory social program. So it isn't just, gee, you're in poverty, here's some money. Basis is, what have you contributed? It's ostensibly somewhat redistributive. However, the high-income people tend to live longer. So in fact, it's, at the end of the day, fairly proportional. So the, in general, the payouts are not too far away to the amount of money that's put in terms of life expectancy. So it's got the feature that you don't outlive it, which is also attractive. It's one of the few life annuities that's indexed for inflation. It's very difficult to buy an annuity and say, well, I want it going into the future as long as I live to rise at the unknown future inflation rate. So it's a very attractive program. I think it's going to be some of three things: somewhat higher tax rates, a lot of encouragement so that there's more incentives to keep working, particularly if you're healthy. And then third, people are going to respond if those structures are okay. They're going to respond if their health is good to working to later years.
All I can say is if you're young, start putting it in that 401k right now, because you're going to be sorry when you're 67 and there's only $8,000 in the account. That's going to be a bad deal for you.
That is certainly the case. I mean, and I think for many people, it is the case that Social Security will be quite substantial, but for many others, they may have not contributed as much to Social Security. Certainly it's not going to support their lifestyle. And if they don't have a successful pension that they've built up, they're going to be at a much lower standard of living. People don't like to reduce their standard of living. We see that people don't cut down on their consumption, or at least don't want to. They don't say, well, I'm going to have a simple life and live in a small village in the middle of nowhere. So they want to stay in the city. They want to have a car. They want to have a vacation. So their standard of living, to protect that, they're going to have to put in money in a 401k. They're also going to have to avoid the temptation to think, oh, this is a once-in-a-lifetime event. I got divorced or I'm moving. So a lot of people, when they have a life event, they all of a sudden don't account for long-term commitment. And they tap into it, which prevents an accumulation going forward. And they have to pay a penalty if they tap in under age 59 and a half.
That's Frank Stafford, a professor of economics at the University of Michigan. Thanks for helping us understand these 401ks a little better.
Well, it's a definitely important issue.
Am I curious?
Am I curious?
Am I curious?
There's a lot to talk about in this diverse state of ours, and we can't possibly know about it all. That's where you come in. We want to know what you're curious about. If you've got a question about Michigan, something you've always wondered about, send it along to us by going to the Am I Curious page at michiganradio.org. Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Thanks for listening. Talk to you tomorrow.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.